Good afternoon. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Don Cleveland, the first speaker in the NIH Neuroscience Lecture Series in year 2008. And Dr. Cleveland received his bachelor's degree in physics and a PhD degree in biochemistry. And he did his postdoc in UCSF, and he joined the faculty of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in 1981 as assistant professor first, then climbing the academic ladder to be for full professorship at Hopkins and in the Department of Biological Chemistry. He left Hopkins in 1995 and joined the faculty of the UCSD. And currently, Dr. Cleveland is the professor of the Department of Cellular Molecular Medicine, Department of Medicine, Department of Neuroscience of UCSD. He's also head of the Laboratory of Cell Biology in the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Biology, Cancer Research. Dr. Cleveland has made many contributions to both basic and clinical research, has made many pioneering discoveries, including studied chromosome movement and cell cycle control during cell division, and also in the pathogenic mechanism of neurodegenerative disease. Among his many contributions, it is important to note that Don is first to clone the tubulin genes, and he is also the first to purify the tau protein. As we know, tau is the major component in the neurofibrillary tangles of Alzheimer's disease. And also for the past decades, Don really has led effort in studying the pathogenic mechanism of ALS, which he's going to talk about today. In recognition of his work, Don has received many awards and honors, including election to both the National Academy of Science and the American Academy of Arts and Science in year 2006. So welcome, Don, to NIH.
Hello. Yes. Thank you, Wyman, and it's great to be here at the source of the money, and to see many colleagues. Actually, and I want to thank you for coming out on this bright spring day in the middle of winter. So what I'd like to do today is begin with a discussion of some basic aspects of ALS, more familiarly in this country, Lou Gehrig's disease. And I know that most of you know the primary aspects of this disease, but just to be sure that we're all on a common page, the primary event that leads to paralysis in this age-dependent disease is the selective premature death of upper and lower motor neurons. The courses of these neurons and their axonal processes have been known for more than 100 years, mapped out by the great neuroanatomists, including Ramon y Cajal, with the upper motor neurons sending their processes down from the brain through the spinal cord, where they synapse directly or more frequently indirectly onto the lower motor neurons, whose job it is to trigger the muscles to contract. And indeed, it was the recognition that in ALS that there is premature death of the upper motor neurons that gives rise to a myelin pallor, the absence of or the diminution of myelin in this region of the spinal cord, that led Jean-Martin Charcot to originally describe the disease academically and to name it ALS. The disease is a late onset disease, typically initiating in the mid-50s. Wait, late onset. That's my age. It's an early midlife onset disease, but almost invariably progressive to death over time course of a handful of years. And your lifetime risk, our lifetime risk, is between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 2,000 of getting disease. And the almost all instances of disease do not have a clear genetic component, but in 10% of the cases, the disease is inherited in a dominant manner. And indeed, recognition of the first of those gene products that whose mutation can give rise to dominantly inherited ALS really began the molecular story within the causes of ALS. And the primary paper is this one, led by a worldwide team, including led by Bob Brown, in which it was discovered that mutations in a very well-known enzyme, superoxide dismutase, gave rise to dominantly inherited ALS. And for the biochemists, one of the premier examples of which is here at NIH, Earl Statman, this enzyme was a very well-known enzyme, and indeed its crystal structure was known. It's a small homodimer. And here I've illustrated that homodimeric structure. It's actually one of the two experiments I'm going to show you today that I did personally. I took the crystal structure and I colored it. Now, I colored it after a follow-up paper appeared in Science very shortly after the original discovery of these mutations, in which it was proposed that the mutations lay along the dimer axis and destabilized dimerization led to loss of enzymatic activity, and that would then be a descriptor of the mechanistic process by loss of activity. And then a third paper appeared in Nature with a mutation which apparently affected the activity of the wild-type allele in dominantly inherited disease, and that added further weight to the argument that loss of enzymatic activity would cause disease. And so what I did was to then map, at a time that there were about 50 mutations known, just map where those mutations were. And every place there's a color is where there's a mutant. And there are now 2.5 times as many mutants known. The fact is, there's no surface of this protein that escapes mutation that gives rise to dominantly inherited disease. Now, what does the enzyme normally do? It takes superoxide, produced typically as an error of mitochondrial energetics, and converts it to molecular oxygen or to hydrogen peroxide. In two asymmetric steps in which a catalytic copper oscillates between a reduced and an oxidized form. And it's a dismutase because it takes the same product to the same substrate to two different products, in case that comes up on the exam later. Now, it's a very well known small homodimer. It actually has one really unusual property, which is that it is among the most stably folded intracellular proteins known. It remains mostly fully folded in strong protein denaturants and retains enzymatic activity in 8-molar urea, for example. It does chemistry with a catalytic copper and a structural zinc. It's also an abundant protein, so it's just under 1% of total brain protein, which makes it, in brain, more abundant than some structural proteins that you've heard of, if you don't think about them, like actin. It's more abundant on a molar basis than actin. And as a cause of a selective killing of late-onset motor neurons, it was a surprising choice. And for those who are involved in the genetics, are involved in genetics, you know that in a gene search, you always stop when you find the gene. And sure enough, this was the last gene that they looked at, that consortium looked at. But in fact, at the time, it was the last known gene in the locus, because it just, on chromosome 21, it just seemed so unlikely to be the cause of disease since it was ubiquitously expressed. Now, in the ensuing 15 years, a consensus has been reached that these mutations, all of them are dominant, these mutations cause disease not through loss of enzymatic activity, but through acquisition of one or more toxic properties. And I'll just briefly summarize that evidence. The initial evidence came from David Borschelt and his colleagues at Hopkins, where he showed that some of the mutations retain full activity as dismutases, both in cell culture and in patients. and yet they cause disease. And with now more than 100 mutations known, none of them are the simple null mutations that would preclude the synthesis of a full-length or nearly full-length polypeptide, precisely the mutations that should be abundantly present if it were true that simple loss of activity could cause disease. And then in the second experiment that I did personally, we showed that there's no correlation between the retention of dismutase activity and the age of disease onset or duration of human disease. And I did that experiment by telephone. And that is, we had measured the enzymatic activities of a variety of mutants, and I then called clinicians around the world and asked them for the ages of disease onset and duration of disease of patients with known mutations. And what emerged from that is that it's completely uncorrelated. And then lastly, in an experiment that shocked almost all of us, the complete deletion of this antioxidant, abundant antioxidant, deletion in mice, did not produce the expected embryonic lethality, but instead it produced mice that are not compromised in lifespan. So, and that in the laboratory caging setting are indistinguishable from wild-type mice. They're not completely normal by any stretch. In fact, if you challenge them with ischemic insults, they're in much worse shape. But it's not quite as an essential gene as had been predicted. And yet, if you express the ALS-linked mutants in mice, you produce progressive fatal motor neuron disease, typically beginning with hind limb weakness and paralysis, moving forward to forelimb. It's a pretty good replica of what you might expect of progressive disease, progressive heritable disease. Now, in searching for what is the property that is acquired by these mutations, one key experiment was done by Lucy Bruin, which she, now the vice president of the ALS Association. And what she did was to ask, does dismutase activity play any role in the pathogenic process? And the way she did that was to take an SOD1 mutation where the glycine substituted to arginine in position 85, G85R. This mutation retains no activity as a dismutase. And she mated it to the cephalon deletion mouse in which the endogenous SOD1 alleles had been deleted. So she could ask, what happens to disease course in animals that have a dismutase inactive mutant in the presence of normal SOD activity levels or reduced levels, including zero levels? And as you can see here, the answer is, there is no effect on toxicity from this inactive mutant, even when you entirely remove the wild-type protein. So if it were true that the mutant protein competed with the wild-type protein for access to something like superoxide or any spontaneous reaction product of superoxide, then you would strongly predict that eliminating the endogenous alleles would exacerbate disease, and that is not true. Moreover, the converse experiment of taking a dismutase inactive mutant and raising overall dismutase activity levels chronically throughout this mouse by the addition of a transgene encoding the human wild-type protein. It does raise dismutase activities everywhere in this mouse, and yet that has no effect on ameliorating disease either. So from that, we concluded that toxicity is neither related to superoxide or superoxide-dependent catalysis by mutant SOD1. So what is it that's toxic? And I admit that when those original mutations were reported in 1993, I could not have imagined that by 2008 we had not come to agreement on what is the toxicity. But there you have it. There are several proposals. They include damage to mitochondria from selective association of misfolded mutant SOD1 with mitochondria, but only within affected tissue types. This is a favored hypothesis by some, including me, and I shall show you none of the primary evidence for it today, but I do think that mitochondria are probably centrally involved in disease. Misfolded SOD1 is a constant feature of these mutant proteins. And others have proposed that what the misfolded protein may do is poison the proteasome or the protein folding chaperones. such misfolded protein in the form of aggregates may also disrupt the axonal organization, especially of neurofilaments, and thereby block aspects of axonal transport. The misfolded SOD1 may drive glutamate-mediated excitotoxicity by damaging not just the neurons, but non-neuronal neighbors, a point that I'm going to amplify on in a moment. And in a final hypothesis put forward by Jean-Pierre Julien in Canada, it may be true that mutant SOD1 is inappropriately secreted from one or more cell types, and that extracellular SOD1 is what is really toxic, or at least is what is a piece of the toxicity. Now, we have not settled on which one or ones of these are the primary contributors. But independent of that, what is clear in dominantly inherited disease is that you could affect the disease course if you could simply lower the levels of the mutant proteins synthesized, independent of what the toxicity really was. So in an effort to begin that, what Tim Miller did in my group was to take use a viral transcription-mediated siRNA to try to lower the synthesis of mutant SOD1 in target tissues. He did so by making a small virus that encodes this siRNA to SOD1, the virus, the adeno-associated virus, and inject it into a muscle, exploiting the property of AAV that it can be taken up at the neuromuscular junction, retrogradely transported back to the motor neuron soma, where it gets uncoated, some of the DNA gets taken up into the nucleus, where it is then maintained episomally in mice for at least a year. And therefore, one can ask, if you can lower the synthesis in motor neurons of SOD1, can you affect disease course? So building such a transcription-mediated siRNA specific, selective for SOD1 is quite straightforward to do. You can introduce such a construct into cultured cells and suppress the accumulation of SOD1. And now one can take those virus, and in our experiment, there were three simultaneous experiments done by three different teams. Ours is by far the most simple-minded, but I hope you'll be able to keep up with it. Really simple-minded. So inject one set of muscles in one hind limb, not the other, and now ask, comparing the ability to maintain grip strength on two sides, the injected side and the mock-injected side, can we slow the paralytic process? So if you look in young rodents, normal animals gain strength over 2 to 3 months of age, probably not surprising, but these mice that express ALS-causing SOD1 mutations diverge from that normal strength curve right here, providing a simple measure for the timing of disease onset when they fail to make that age-dependent increase in strength. Injection of muscles on one hind limb, retains grip strength throughout that entire period, and we were very pleased that we have now slowed the onset of disease by limiting mutant synthesis in motor neurons in the neurons that are innervating the muscles that we've injected. And we, unlike the other two groups, I contributed in a third way directly to an experiment. This is a PI-induced mistake. I said, well, you have to keep following them. And the problem with that is it doesn't last. So treating the motor neurons to synthesize lower levels of mutant, it offers an initial benefit that does not last. And indeed, that's not true. That was true not just for this example, but for a second example from Azuz and colleagues at Oxford Biomedica, who used a very similar viral-mediated siRNA, but they injected every muscle you could possibly get to in a very young mouse, a 7-day-old mouse. It's a heroic experiment in terms of administering that many virus, and they had a terrific effect on slowing disease onset in a very early onset, rapidly progressive model. They slowed disease onset by 100 days. But administering that siRNA primarily targeted to motor neurons very early in the life of this mouse, slowed onset, but had no benefit, was of no benefit on slowing the rate of disease progression after onset. In fact, if you look at the data from the paper, it accelerated the disease progression after onset. So both of those experiments really beg the question, so what are the target cells that develop the toxicity that ultimately leads to the killing of the motor neurons from a ubiquitously expressed mutant protein? So is it true if you have a mutant neuron, this red one, mutant neuron embedded in a normal neighborhood, does the neuron develop damage all by itself in a cell autonomous way? And conversely, if you have a normal neuron embedded in a bad mutant neighborhood, does it acquire toxicity from its neighbors? And as a way of testing that, what we initially chose to do was to build mice that were mixtures of mutant-expressing and normal cells, chimeric animals. Here's one such example, as you can see by the mottled coat color. So if you make mice that express the mutant SOD1 at high levels in a proportion of the neurons and non-neuronal cells, is it true that the expression within individual neurons is sufficient to target that neuron for premature death or premature degeneration? And here's there are a total of 77 animals that were made and analyzed, and they were analyzed as a consortium effort, some made in my group, some made by Bob Brown at Mass General Hospital, and some made by Jean-Pierre Julien. And I'll just show you one example. Here's a mouse where we have marked the axons in a motor route. They're coming out of the spinal cord. All of the axons are motor axons. And we've marked them as either mutant, in green, by the presence of the mutant protein, or normal by the presence of an epitope-tagged neurofilament subunit. And as you can see, we can uniquely score them as mutant or normal by using that epitope-tagging approach. And indeed, in this mouse, about a third of the axons are mutant-expressing, and yet this mouse completely escaped disease. In fact, we let this mouse live twice the maximal lifespan of the germline mice. And when we sacrificed it and looked at the entire motor routes, like this one, the fifth lumbar route, which typically has about 1,000 axons in it, all 1,000 axons were still present, and with no evidence of degeneration, despite the fact that 35% of those axons were expressing this mutant protein at high levels. Therefore, initiation of disease, even on a neuron-by-neuron basis, is not sufficient for having high-level synthesis of mutant protein within individual neurons. Okay. So, am I fading out? Did I fade out? Shall I speak up? Hello? Talk. Am I talking again? Yes. Okay, so we seem a little echoey, but maybe just on the podium. All right, so having built chimeric animals of three different strategies, what none of the strategies did was give a hint as to what the other cell types might be that could control the rate of motor neuron degeneration from these a ubiquitously expressed SOD1 mutant. So to try to do that, what Koji Yamanaka and Severin Boyer did was to build a new transgene in which they took an authentic human SOD1 gene expressing a mutant protein and flank it with LOX recombination sites so that we could generate animals that express ubiquitously a mutant protein but could then and will get disease and then start removing synthesis of the mutant product from individual cell types. And which cell types? Well, the obvious one would be the motor neuron itself. But others that would be of initial interest would include the muscle, the target for these motor neurons, the microglial cells, the immune cells of the spinal cord, and the astrocytes that are an obligate partner to the motor neurons, especially for handling glutamate biology. So what happens if you take an animal that generates fatal disease from expressing a mutant ubiquitously and start removing its expression from motor neurons? And here's what, in this case, we used an islet-1 Cree mouse built by Tom Jussel, and we've repeated this experiment. It's exactly the same with a Cree expressed off a CHAP promoter. And what one sees is that there is a delay in disease onset, about 50 days, and an extension of survival by a bit more than that. So lowering mutant synthesis within motor neurons primarily slows the timing of disease onset with a very modest effect on slowing progression after onset. And in this example, the gene excision is only about 30% efficient. That is, we only get about 30% gene excision from the motor neurons. And so these are the minimum effects that one would get from diminishing mutant action in motor neurons. But it's fully consistent with what you saw from that siRNA viral approach as well, which is lowering or limiting mutant synthesis in motor neurons affects the timing of disease onset, but does not have a strong effect on slowing progression after onset. So what kind of components could really contribute to a neuron-specific effect from mutant SOD1? And I'll just give you one example. So if you look at mature axoplasm in a large myelinated motor axon, this is a quick freeze deep etch image from Hirakawa from a lot of years ago. And what one sees is that axoplasm of these large axons, so these motor neurons are, our lower motor neurons, are the largest cells in the body with, they're about 5,000 times the volume of a typical cell, with 99.99% of that cell in the axon. The axons are well structured. Here's the microtubule, which serves as a substrate for axonal transport. But all the rest of the filaments in the field are neurofilaments, the intermediate filament proteins of axons, and they are cross-bridged to each other by these little domains that I've illustrated in yellow, and it's clear that those bridges are largely provided by by bridges that extend from the core of a neurofilament. They are the neurofilament tail domains of the two larger neurofilament subunits, NFM and NFH. And those have been proposed for many years, some a lot from my group, to be structural linkers within axoplasm that allow for one of the functional properties of neurofilaments in axons, which is as an intrinsic determinant of axonal caliber. So as a test of the implication of disorganized neurofilaments in ALS has been long known, and Hirano and his colleagues, who are themselves responsible for well over 50% of the pathology known for ALS. It was his conclusion in the early 90s that misaccumulation of neurofilaments in the motor neurons at risk are really one of the apparently early changes. And here is one such example where you see misorganized tangles of neurofilaments within a motor neuron cell body in a sporadic ALS case, and an even older example of a ballooned axon. Here's the cell body, there's the axon, and a ballooned axon, which at the EM level is just full of disorganized neurofilaments. And all of those propose that neurofilaments, at least their disorganization, could be a part of the pathogenic process. So to test whether neurofilaments could play an intrinsic role in SOD-mediated disease by action within the neurons, what Christian Leipziger did was to take mice which had been engineered to remove those long tail cross-bridging domains of NFH and NFM, and just to remove them completely by building gene-targeted mice in which we replaced the endogenous genes was once truncated in those entire cross-bridging domains. And now ask,
what happens to disease when you remove those impediments, if you will, those structural elements that you can imagine would slow aspects of axonal transport. And what happens is that mice developing disease from SOD1 mutants get disease, but they get it later. They get it substantially later, and the benefit is exclusively on slowing the age of disease onset. There's no effect on slowing disease progression. So all of the experiments, the original siRNA approach, the selective gene deletion approach, and removal of components intra-axonal, all of them lead to a common outcome that damage from SOD1 mutants within the motor neurons is a key component of initiating disease, but is not an important component for the rate at which disease progresses after onset. I'm going to skip that. So who are the components that are really important? And so an obvious candidate would be the target muscles, certainly for the lower motor neurons. They're intimately associated with these motor neurons. They make mutant SOD1. And indeed, one of the earliest pathologies seen in all of the mouse models is denervation, the withdrawal of the motor axon from the neuromuscular junction. And you can see that. Here's an image taken from Annalise Schaefer's paper where she and Josh Sange used some very cleverly marked mice, so that if you see a typical motor axon innervating a muscle, you see the motor axon, which has been colored with GFP, and the neuromuscular junction has now been labeled with a red bungrotoxin, so you can see the fully innervated one gives a yellow appearance. A partially denervated muscle appears with the green axon and a very little overlap with receptors labeled with bungrotoxin, and a fully denervated one is where you see the axon itself has withdrawn from the muscle. And that's a very early feature of disease in all of these animals. So what happens is that mediated at least in part by damage accrued within the muscle itself. If it were true, of course, the muscles are in some ways an easier target for a therapeutic approach than are things inside the spinal cord. So what Tim Miller did was to take a mouse which expresses the Cre recombinase selectively within a subset of muscles and mate that to our mouse which expresses an SOD1 mutation that can be selectively deleted by the action of the Cre recombinase. And when he did that, he produced mice that make, within the muscle, make about half the initial level of the mutant protein. Now, this is not 100%, it's 50%, but by all measures, the level of transgene synthesis by a factor of 2 is a very big predictor on the age of disease onset. So we really would have expected to affect the disease by lowering mutant by this level. And what actually happened, however, was that lowering mutant synthesis in the muscles did not affect onset, it did not affect survival, it just didn't affect anything. And in fact, we did the experiment as well by using viral-mediated siRNA delivered to muscles using viruses that are not retrogradely transported to the nervous system. The level of diminished synthesis is about the same, and there is no benefit. So diminishing mutant synthesis in muscle is of no benefit in slowing disease. So if it's not the muscle, what other cells might be involved? And the first one we tested was the potential involvement of the innate immune system, the microglial cells within the central nervous system. These microglia come from a common myeloid progenitor, and they come either through a pathway that gives rise to peripheral monocytes or directly to a CNS precursor. But nevertheless, they are embedded into the spinal cord early in postnatal life, and all of the cells from this overall lineage, myeloid lineage, express on their cell surfaces an integrin named CD11B. In the case of the microglia, in almost every example of neurodegenerative disease, the microglia recognize damage and they become activated and proliferate in response to that damage. So to test whether that activation and proliferation might actually, instead of be protective against damage, but might fuel that damage, we exploited the recognition that CD11B is made by exclusively within this myeloid lineage, and built and characterized a new mouse that expresses the Cre recombinase from the CD11B promoter. And I didn't put that evidence in today, but the expression of the Cre recombinase is exclusive to the myeloid lineage, and we have no evidence, despite looking very hard, no evidence for its expression outside the myeloid lineage. So what happens if you selectively lower mutant synthesis within these microglial cells in the presence of an ALS-causing SOD1 mutant? And as you can see here in the survival curve, mice that express the gene product everywhere uniformly die with everyone dead by about 275 days. But after gene excision from the myeloid cells, these mice live longer. Some of them live very, very much longer, on an average 100 days longer. And if you take a disease point at which, if I showed you the movies, every last one of you would be able to recognize that the mice were not moving normally and call that an early phenotypic disease state, and then ask, from that early phenotypic disease state, how much longer do the mice live when you have removed mutant synthesis from the microglia or when you haven't? And the answer is they live 75 days longer from a clear phenotypic disease time point when you've limited mutant synthesis in the microglia. In other words, almost all of this benefit, survival benefit, accrues from slowing disease progression after phenotypic onset. And a very similar outcome came from a very different experimental approach, came from Stan Appel and his colleagues at Baylor, who used bone marrow transplantation to substitute mutant-expressing microglia with normal ones, and they got exactly the same outcome. No effect on a disease onset, but a slowing of disease progression after onset. So here's a cell type who accrues damage within it from expressing mutant SOD1, and that damage drives the rate of disease progression without affecting disease onset. Okay, so what about the astrocytes? Now, astrocytes are well known in their biology of disease as mediators of synaptic glutamate. Within the spinal cord, the only glutamate transporter that accumulates to any credible level is EAAT2, which is made exclusively by the astrocytes. The job of EAAT2 is to rapidly recover synaptic glutamate to turn off an initial excitatory signal. Without that, without E2, then there will be higher levels of synaptic glutamate, which will lead to repetitive firing and potentially even high levels of intracellular calcium mediated through calcium permeable glutamate receptors. So the end product of that is usually referred to as excitotoxicity from repetitive firing and that calcium entry. In these models of inherited ALS in rodents, it's very clear that there is a focal loss of that glutamate transporter, that astrocytic glutamate transporter. Here, the brown staining in a normal animal shows you the disposition and location of this glutamate transporter in normal animals. And here you can see the focal loss after disease initiation, focal loss in an animal that expresses one of the ALS-causing mutations. And that loss is not simply loss at the immunocytochemical level. You can show it at the biochemical level by dissection and immunoblotting. So that evidence really firmly suggested that the astrocytes must play some role in disease by failing to metabolize glutamate in an appropriate way. But to test that really directly, what Koji Yamanaka did was to take the mouse in which you can selectively delete the mutant SOD1 transgene and made it to a mouse that expresses within the spinal cord expresses the Cre recombination exclusively within astrocytes to get gene silencing within astrocytes. And in this particular case, the gene silencing is really good. But that by all the measures, we get at least 3/4 of the genes that are excised. And again, we have no evidence for gene excision in the spinal cord in any other cell type than astrocytes. So what happens to survival? So you, looking at onset removal of mutant protein from astrocytes has no effect on disease onset, but has a robust effect on slowing disease progression after onset, much as we've seen in the microglial case. And again, there is absolutely no evidence for gene excision here in the microglial cells. So we conclude from this that each of two primary non-neuronal cells accrue damage within them from synthesizing mutant SOD, and that damage fuels the speed of disease progression without affecting onset. Okay. So is it true that motor neurons develop damage that drives disease onset? Are they the only cells that drive onset? And to try to test that, what Koji Yamanaka, Severin Boyer, along with Larry Goldstein have done is to build a new set of chimeric mice in which we've engineered them by the genetics to be 100% of the motor neurons in these mice will be mutant expressing at high levels. And the way we did that was to take embryos from a mouse that is homozygous for an oleg mutation. And the oleg mutation has been well characterized that you, in the presence of that mutation, you cannot make oligodendrocytes or motor neurons. And we combine those embryos with mutant-expressing embryos such that if there are viable mice that are born, it must be true that all of the motor neurons and oligodendrocytes are derived from the mutant embryo, since from the SOD1 mutant embryo, since the oleg mutant embryo can't make them at all. And so, yes, we were able to make such mice. Here is one of these animals. And now the test, is it true that the motor neurons in those mice, 100% of them are mutant? And by scoring for the presence of the mutant protein here in a motor root, yes, 100% of them are mutant, as predicted. Whereas if you look in the same animals, the sensory neurons are chimeric. Only a fraction of them are mutant. Okay, so it's exactly what you'd expect. These animals have 100% of the motor neurons are mutant, and a variable number of non-motor neurons are either wild-type or mutant. What happens to their survival? And the answer is, if you look at the germline mice that express the mutant protein everywhere, no mouse survives past about 175 days. But 4 of 5 of these oleg chimeric mice, where 100% of the motor neurons are mutant, 4 of 5 completely escape disease. They escape disease onset, and they escaped motor neuron degeneration at ages well past the time of disease initiation in the germline mice. Therefore, there must be non-motor neurons who express mutant SOD1 that drive disease initiation, because in these examples, 100% of the motor neurons are expressing the mutant protein at high levels, and yet we have delayed disease onset. Now, this work, which I've listed here as in limbo, maybe one of you was one of those kind referees who said, well, who cares about that? But I sort of thought disease initiation, knowing the factors that kicked it off, might actually be of interest, and then that it is not true that it is that damage uniquely within motor neurons is the only place in which damage is really accrued. But it is also true what this experiment does not do is to identify which of those cell types are the key initiators. Okay, so so to summarize what we've done thus far, we know motor neurons are one of the driving forces for disease onset. Astrocytes and microglial cells drive progression after onset. The muscle cells don't contribute apparently at all. What else do we have? Tests for the oligodendrocytes, for the Schwann cells are in progress, as is a test for whether the vasculature itself might be involved. But I will close on this phase with one final experiment, which I think makes it all but certain that damage to the vasculature is not just an early event in SOD1-mediated ALS, but is a primary event in initiating disease. And this is an experiment done with Berislav Slakovich at University of Rochester along with us, and it is to ask, is just to look at the capillaries within the spinal cord at pre-symptomatically in every disease model of SOD1-mediated disease in rodents. And here are two examples. And here, this is a very simple immunostaining. This is the kind of staining that PIs can do. You just take your section, and you don't use primary. Just use the secondary antibody looking for leakage of endogenous antibodies into the spinal cord. And if you do that, you see that in normal animals, we never see such leakage, but in these SOD mutant animals, pre-symptomatically, you do see such leakages. And indeed, if you score up the total capillary length in animals looking in normal animals of either of two strain backgrounds, in mice that express human wild-type SOD1 at very high levels, those capillaries are perfect. There are none of these microhemorrhages, but in animals that express each of three different SOD1 mutations, there is an age-dependent loss in total capillary length. And if you then measure correspondingly using radio-labeled tracers to measure blood flow through the spinal cord, there is diminished blood flow in an age-dependent manner in every one of these SOD1 mutant animals, initiating well before disease onset. And so we argue from this that damage to the vasculature takes place very early, and it seems plausible that that damage is one of the key components of driving initial damaging steps. Now, what we haven't shown is that that damage is accrued to the vasculature from mutant action within the cells, as opposed to damage accrued from outside those cells. And that experiment is in progress using the selective gene deletion approach. Okay, so in the last five more minutes, let me summarize what the general disease mechanisms are that have come forward in the last decade. I briefly introduced them earlier. There is a proposal that mutant SOD1 within cells in the nervous system damage mitochondria. There's another proposal that there's damage to the astrocytes, especially through their ability to regulate synaptic glutamate. Their microglial cells drive disease progression, presumably by some intramicroglial cell damage, which feeds through the typical processes within microglial cells to make these firemen, the cells that come in to clean up damage, instead of cleaning up, they drive damage, like a fireman who's driving a fire truck that's leaking gasoline. And there are also proposals for disorganization of axoplasm and errors of axonal transport, potentially lowering capacity of intracellular protein chaperones or the proteasome. And if you go to meetings, you know how speaker one tells you how it's the mitochondria? Speaker two says it's a proteasome. Speaker three said it's the microglial cells. And then Julian gets up last and says it's the secreted SOD1. And what I'd like to leave you with, if nothing else, is that it's not true that my model is right and your model is wrong. It's actually, I would propose that all the models are right, are partly right. In fact, disease selectivity of a ubiquitously expressed mutant protein, I think, is best described by damage to multiple cell types. It's the accidental convergence of damage to multiple cell types, which then provokes age-dependent disease. You need damage to multiple cell types to initiate disease, and you need damage to even additional cell types to drive disease progression. So if that were true, then you might ask, so how would you approach disease? And when we published our first experiment in Science in 2003 implicating non-neuronal cells as a component of disease, a condition of publication, you know how you fight, maybe you guys don't fight getting your work into print, but you fight with our editors, and a condition of publication because of the referees was that we eliminate all reference to non-cell autonomous disease and any implication for what that lesson might have for stem cell therapy. And I kept arguing with the editor saying, I thought that was the only reason science would be interested in the work because of those two things. But anyway, that is the implication that wild-type cells can affect the disease course, either initiation or progression, really does have impact on stem cell therapy approaches, or even more so on gene therapy approaches, because you need to know which cells you really want to target. Already I've shown you examples of targeting the neurons alone, which can affect disease onset, but cannot slow disease progression after onset. So I'm going to close with one example of trying to bring this really to a gene silencing approach. And the approach that we're going to use is an old one. So some of you old timers will remember, and some of you younger ones will have, here it is. So it's not to use siRNAs, although that would be an alternative, but I'll come to why we've chosen this one. It's to use DNA oligonucleotides, antisense oligonucleotides. The DNA, when hybridized to an RNA, makes the RNA a substrate for an endogenous nuclear enzyme RNase H. So we're going to exploit that by adding DNA oligonucleotides to organisms into the nervous system, hoping to target for degradation SOD1. The beauty to using DNA oligonucleotides is that they have two properties that siRNAs do not yet have. One, they're really stable. Two, they can be built in commercial amounts and used today. So, but how do you get them into the nervous system? And it's not elegant, but it's to use surgical intervention to insert a catheter either directly into the ventricle or directly into the spinal cord, and then exploit already existing pumps, particularly the ones made by Medtronic, which are regulatable, refillable pumps. And patients, especially for chronic back pain, have had these pumps implanted in them for now more than a decade. And so we know that we can deliver on a chronic basis antisense oligonucleotides to the nervous system, and if we can identify ones that are effective in lowering SOD1 synthesis. And so we did that by synthesizing a whole slew of them and identifying the handful that were really effective and identify the lead one to take to human practice. And here it is, where if you infuse it into, in this case, a normal rat, and look at the level of SOD1 mRNA before and after infusion, and infusion with a scrambled oligo, you can see we can lower SOD1 levels to about 40% their original ones, really near the site of infusion here in the ventricle. But actually, you can get all the way down to the bottom of the spinal cord. In fact, if you look for the oligos, you can deliver them all the way down the spinal cord. This is true in rodents. This is true in non-human primates. And you can do it backwards. If you put it into the intrathecally, you can deliver them not quite as uniformly, but throughout the nervous system as well. So exploiting that, can we affect disease by infusing these antisense oligos into the spinal cord, in this case of an SOD transgenic rat? And the answer is yes. We can extend survival by about 30 days, and the benefit is exclusively by slowing progression after onset. So this is actually, from a treatment point of view, this is one of the better treatments that have been done. They're in these SOD rodent models. And on the basis of that, we've planned a small human trial, which we hope will initiate this quarter. The method is to, it, we know is capable of delivery of antisense oligos to neurons and their neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods that are involved in all of the major neurodegenerative diseases. It's a catalytic RNA destruction method, just like siRNAs are. It's capable of lowering the synthesis of a gene product that's as much as 5% of total brain protein. It's unlike viral, the current generation of viral approaches, it's regulatable. So we can, because we can use these Medtronic pumps where you can infuse more or less or turn them off. And today, it's commercially feasible today because these antisense oligonucleotides can be made on commercial scales. And at least as well as when administered in the periphery, a series of trials already gone forward in other, for other indications have shown that these antisense oligos are safe when administered in humans. So we hope that a small trial, 16-patient trial, led by Merit Sokowitz and MGH, will get started in this quarter to test safety in familial patients. But we have, I would add as a closing comment that if, in fact, this approach is safe and tolerated, there are other disease targets that are immediately apparent. Perhaps the poster disease of which is Huntington's disease, another dominant disease, but unlike ALS, where only a handful of cases are inherited, in Huntington's disease, 100% of the instances are from mutation in the same gene, and it's a truly dominant disease. So we have identified the oligos for Huntington's, assuming that we have success with safety in the ALS patients. So lastly, I think I gave credit to those who've done the work as I went along. Severin Boyer and Koji Yamanaka, two very talented postdocs involved in the non-cell autonomous work. Tim Miller led the work to use viral-mediated siRNA delivery as a treatment. And Richard Smith and Tim Miller led the work along with our corporate colleagues, Isis Pharmaceuticals, in taking an antisense oligonucleotide treatment for neurodegenerative disease. And when you're at NIH, you can't help but thank those who signed the checks. So the lion's share of this work has been supported by a single R01, and I thank the leadership of NINDS for their continuing support. Thanks much. Mark.
In your diagram of the non-cell autonomous, one thing I didn't see was for the neurons.
So why didn't I, in those diagrams about non-cell autonomous, consider the interneurons? Probably because I left them out without so you're absolutely right. There are other neurons, and that would be a good target as well. There's no reason to exclude other neurons. You're absolutely right. Does any of you have a good interneuron Cre? You know, that would. In what context, Ron?
In all these assays, I mean, you show onset and you show survival. But what happens if you look at motor neurons themselves?
I see. So in looking at onset and survival, Ron's asking, what actually happens to motor neuron number?
You showed us the Josh Sain's technology with the axons coming away from the neurons.
Yes. Yeah. So the bad news is that that hasn't quite been done, Ron, as well as you would like, because at onset, it could be done, but at onset, counting those motor neurons, you need twice as many animals. You have to kill your animals. You can measure phenotypic onset. And so, in fact, we didn't do that in most of those examples. We didn't have twice the cohort to sample at that time point. So we know how many motor neurons there are at end stage, but we don't quite know how many there were at onset. So actually you raise a good point. That has not been done carefully in any of these experiments. And I'm not taking full credit for that. The whole field can have credit too. So we just haven't done that very well. So the microhemorrhages, we've looked throughout the spinal cords. So you see them at all levels of the spinal cord. Do you see them in the brains of those animals? I don't think we have fully looked. All through the spinal cord. So you're not just in the ventral. So do we see them outside the ventral horn? It's a really good question, Ron. I know it's known, and I don't know. Let me rephrase that. I shall know very shortly.
Yeah. So I have a question about the role of microglia in modern neural degeneration. So normally you see the microglia cells are degenerated in a mouse model, but when you remove the mutant SOD in the cells, the microglia cell healthy, the more functional. It's possible like you think about like a future healthy microglia cell able to rescue the...
Yeah, so the question was about microglial cells, and the way we've interpreted our experiment is that we've taken mutant microglial cells that have retained some normal function of microglia in helping clear damage, and we've replaced them with really healthy microglial cells that can really clear damage without doing damage. And so I think your question was, could we then, as a microglial cells, could that normal ones, could that be beneficial in patients? And it certainly is in mice, so that Stan Appel did that experiment in mice and slowed disease progression. In patients, the good news and bad news is it was done in patients. Stan Appel did that as well, although he did it in sporadic patients, and that there really wasn't a benefit. And so, that you know, one failed experiment doesn't mean that the approach would necessarily fail, but it is a problem. In the sense of how do you get rid of the endogenous cells. So if you're going to do radiation, which is what Appel did in his human experiment, now you worry about all the damage that you introduced there. So in terms of stem cell approaches, would it be sensible to try to put in myeloid precursors and hope that you could change the balance of mutant versus normal ones? Maybe. The same for astrocytes. If, you know, in California, the idea of using stem cell therapy with the California Stem Cell Initiative, we see it in the newspapers all the time, and ALS is always one of the diseases that are claimed. But for me, the replacement of motor neurons, the time scale on which they regrow is really discouraging. But perhaps replacing some of the non-neuronal neighbors like the astrocytes might be a more feasible approach. And they can affect, at least in these rodent examples, they affect disease progression, which you might really care about. Yeah, so what would happen if you removed microglia? And that experiment was done. It was done by Jean-Pierre Julien, and the answer was it made things worse. So that tells us the microglia are actually good, and that so removing them is not what you really want to do. So killing them off is not good. But I think all of those experiments are completely consistent, which is that the microglia do something healthy in trying to protect against neurodegenerative damage, but they can also be bad if they themselves are mutants.
And what do you think is the mechanism for the vascular leakage?
So what do I think is the mechanism for the vascular leakage? So I would like to argue on the strength of no evidence at all that there is internal damage within those endothelial cells of the vasculature from their own expression of mutant SOD1, and that makes them, you know, obviously they come together to make a structure which keeps stuff in, and that they become weakened internally by their own synthesis of mutant SOD1. But you know, so parts of that are directly testable. We are choosing to test it in the longer range one of using a Cre that's expressed in those endothelial cells and to remove mutant synthesis from the vasculature and ask whether that really affects disease course. There are hints that the vasculature can be involved. The first hint came from the deletion in mice of the hypoxia responsive element from VEGF, and that produces motor neuron disease. So that presumably is an effect within those endothelial cells themselves. So but as I've already admitted, there's no direct experiment for that. No, it was not endothelial specific. So you are correct, quite correct that I've glued on. So he's criticizing my answer by saying that when you delete the hypoxia inducing element from VEGF, that's systemically deleted, and so we don't really know which cells in which cells that deletion is really mostly active, or the failure to induce it is mostly active. Nor do we know who is responsive to the VEGF. And I agree with you on all fronts there. Yeah. Yeah, so I could probably, so the question Ron is now asking, so there is a proposal that at least in a small, in one cohort of patients, that there are mutations in VEGF that may cause disease. And I'm going to take an uncharacteristically agnostic approach on that. So it's in one cohort of, it's been reported in one cohort, and I and the investigators there are standing by that, and others have not confirmed that. Where's Brian? Where's our local geneticist? Or you know? Okay, we'll pick on singletons. I'm confused by that. There's another one, angiogenin, for which mutations appear to in one population but not in another. So I think it's likely For me, I think it's likely that they're playing roles. They're just not as penetrant as genes like SOD1. Kurt, what do you think?
I don't think it's held up very well. So the original report is kind of shifting to saying maybe it's just important in one ethnic population, maybe there are other modifying genes, but the subsequent studies haven't done a good job.
Yeah. Okay, so Kurt says, probably not, that subsequent studies that should have been able to confirm that have really not done that. So I think we're saying very similar things, which is that it's possible there's an effect there, but it's not a very robust one. Yeah, so how does Don account for that specificity? So actually, I do it seriously. I argue that specificity isn't because, of course, the mitochondria aren't important to everybody, and that glutamate transport isn't important to a lot of neurons. It's the accidental convergence. So there is damage to a variety of different cell types, and it's sort of the plane crash model. And we all know that in almost every plane crash, one generator wasn't working, something else wasn't working, the weather was a little bad, and then there was an error made by a controller or a pilot as well. And you could have intervened at any of those levels, and there wouldn't have been a crash. And so I think it's just that you have very large cells that have a huge biosynthetic load, they have glutamatergic inputs, they have friends with whom they interact and need things from, and that it's just the whole thing. It's the whole thing, and I think it's a very positive message because it doesn't. You intervening at any one of those steps could be quite beneficial. Oh yes, what about the other 90%? You are so right. So. It's certainly clear at least to me, that in the other 90%, there are errors of glutamate transport. That was a proposal put forward primarily by Jeff Rothstein and Hopkins. And there is reduced glutamate transport in a large proportion of those patients. And I see no reason not to argue that it would be a convergence of damage to a variety of cell types in the sporadic examples. The most specific part of your question, I think, is there any lesson from SOD1 that directly is relayable into the other 98% of disease? And there, the glass is half full or half empty. So there is one report last year of a identifying an aberrant species of SOD1 present in sporadic patients at high frequency. So if that were confirmed elsewhere and expanded upon, it might be true that you could make SOD1 a key component of sporadic disease. Having said that, the other efforts to find such linkage of SOD1 to sporadic disease, I think a fair assessment is that they've been very disappointing. So I suspect that the field would not accept today that SOD1 does play a role in sporadic disease, and therefore that these lessons may not be readily applicable. Yeah?
Has SOD1 been looked at with regard to the ALS on Guam or the Parkinson's dementia on Guam? Your career is moving you closer to Guam. Has any of this work been getting us to understand either genetics or environmental factors?
So I don't think any of this work has really touched on that. And Kurt, do you know? I don't think so. Yeah.
In all your non-autonomous experiments, you get delay in progression. There's the ultimate pathology in all cases, dealing with different cell types, identical in all cases.
So let me just rephrase that to make sure everybody got that. So in the non-cell autonomous things, in the neurons, the mutant synthesis within them affects onset, not progression. Mutant synthesis in the non-neuronal cells affects progression, not onset. Now, what was your question?
So the ultimate pathology, although you delay progression.
Oh, yeah, pathology. So So the pathology is, so you used in the original, first question you used identical. And so there I'm going to duck. So the data aren't good enough to say identical, but they're quite similar, with the proviso that what we did not do and has not been done by others generally either is to sample large numbers of animals at different stages of disease. So the end-stage pathology is really quite similar. We would not be able to distinguish that if I gave you the sections. But there might be subtle differences, there might be modest differences, and that has not been sampled well enough to tell. Thank you.